From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Despite the chilly gray January weather, it's actually a decent time for birders to see some birds they don't usually see. We'll explore which birds are wintering in the area today. And you can walk into a pet store and buy a parrot, despite the opinion of some bird experts that not only should it not be so easy to procure such a complicated bird, but parrots shouldn't be bred, as there are too many that currently need a home. And we've all heard the stories about Hurricane Florence damaging homes, shuttering businesses, and slowing down economic growth in the short term for the Cape Fear region. But what happened to the coastal bird population? Today, we'll explore those questions and many others with two bird experts. Lindsay Addison is a coastal biologist with Audubon, North Carolina. She manages and studies coastal water birds. Lindsay Addison, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much for having me.
Amelia Mason is founder and director of Skywatch Bird Rescue, a local nonprofit that cares for injured, orphaned, and misplaced birds. Skywatch also seeks to rehabilitate birds and either place them in sanctuaries or return them to the wild. Amelia Mason, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Have you seen birds in places recently that surprised you, or have you seen a kind of bird that you didn't expect to see in the Cape Fear region? Do you have questions about how to deal with a wild bird? Tell us about it on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Lindsay Addison, let's start with the kinds of birds that like to winter in this region. What can local bird watchers or enthusiasts see here now that they wouldn't see in the summer?
So we're really lucky to live on the coast, and that means we get a whole array of all kinds of neat coastal birds. And during migration and winter, and we're in winter right now, we get to see a lot of birds that just about 6 months ago were actually in the Arctic Circle raising their young. And this includes sandpipers and plovers, and a lot of these species are long-distance migrants, so they've come from thousands of miles to winter here. So the birds that you're seeing here on the coast, in a lot of cases, went to a lot of trouble to get here.
Amelia Mason of Skywatch, you've said that you are seeing more of a certain type of bird right now. You've said that if you're seeing herons or egrets hanging out in your backyard or in your backyard pond, there might be an issue there. What's going on?
Right. Every season has a theme, so to speak. So every season we'll see a different theme of birds come in, and within those species, there are certain themes of injuries that will reoccur. Every season is different. When people ask us, what are the most common injuries birds come in with? It really fluctuates, and the trend is season by season. Right now, for example, the last few weeks, we have been receiving a lot of great blue herons. And yes, if you see a bird like that hanging around your backyard all of a sudden and not leaving at sunset, but staying there consecutive days, which as he's never done before, it's probably an indication that something is wrong with that bird. This time of year, a very common issue, it's actually a natural occurring issue, for the great blue herons are parasitic nematodes. So as the weather changes from hot to cool, there's an influx of the parasites within the fish. Those birds will then consume the fish. It completes its life cycle. And then these nematodes, they're called Eustrongylides or Eustrongylidoses, however you want to pronounce it.
Sounds good to me.
It's a nasty worm. It's a nasty nematode, and it will attach itself to the outside of their stomach and bore holes through the lining of the stomach back and forth, basically consuming the whole stomach. So the bird then stops eating, and they slowly begin to starve. When they have those nematodes, they often have other parasites as well that take advantage of a weak host. So ectoparasites, there's some little worms in their mouth called flukes.
Can they be saved if they
yes,
come to
if
you?
Yes, if we get them in early enough, we treat them with antiparasitics and anti-inflammatories and pain medicine, of course. So if you see a heron that does not look obviously injured in any way, in other words, there's no dragging wing or broken leg, but it's just odd that he's hanging around all of a sudden and not flying away. Usually, by the time they're captured, they're very, very weak and exhausted and dehydrated. And if we get them early enough before it's too advanced, we can treat them successfully.
Lindsay Addison, talking about some of the health issues that can afflict birds by season, you say that there is a certain kind of bird that we regularly see on the beach in the winter here, and lots of people love to chase this cute little bird down the beach and get a picture of it. So what are we talking about, and what's wrong with that? Why are you going to break the hearts of bird watchers everywhere?
So as I was saying, a lot of the birds that are here in the wintertime have completed long migrations in order to winter here in southeastern North Carolina. And a lot of the birds that we see a little bit earlier in the season, so kind of late summer and through the fall, are migrating, and they're stopping over here, resting and refueling before continuing on their long trips down to the Caribbean, Central America, or South America. And so one of the most common of these birds that people will recognize or have seen on the beach is the sanderling. It's a little bird smaller than a robin. It's kind of a sandy color, hence its name, and it runs around in the surf like a sewing machine. And this bird actually nests in the Arctic Circle. And so in June and July, it is raising its young up on the tundra in the very northern part of Canada. And in late summer, it begins its migration down the coast. This is very energetically expensive. So while they're not necessarily sick, which they need a lot of energy in order to make these trips. And so if you're needing to fly 3,000 miles from Canada down to the U.S. coast, you need to almost double your body weight with fat that you can burn on your nonstop flight. They'll fly for 2 or 3 days nonstop to get to the next place, and then they need to rest and refuel. And our beaches and our inlets are those refueling stops for these birds, and in the wintertime, it's their home. And they need to be able to eat, and they feed on a lot of little invertebrates that live in the sand. So those little sand fleas or mole crabs that people are familiar with, your kids probably like to dig them up, you use them for bait, that's one of their prey items. They also need to rest, you know, because if you're trying to bulk up and put on all this extra weight, you don't need to waste your calories running around. And unfortunately, birds are really charismatic, they're cool, they fly, and it doesn't seem like it's a problem. You know, oh, you made a bird fly. Well, that's what they do naturally, so how could that be harmful to the bird?
By chasing the bird down the beach trying to get that perfect photograph.
Exactly, or letting your dog run, or just, you know, or not being mindful. If you see a flock of birds on the beach and you walk through it instead of around it, you're causing those birds to fly as well. So you're causing them to burn extra energy that they need to complete their migrations, as well as to survive these cold nights. It's been in the 30s every night for, I think, over a week now. And, you know, so if you're a wintering bird, you need to have your fat coat on. And if you're not able to rest and feed because you're being disturbed by people on the beach, then you're not going to be able to do that as well. So,
but what if I'm the only one who's come along with a camera?
Well, you're probably not the only one. So this is one of those death by a thousand cuts things. If I've got a jar of 100 marbles, and I want to keep, say, I need to keep up to 90 of those marbles, taking one marble out of that jar isn't going to do any damage. But if I've got 10 people in a room and they each take a marble, I have passed my marble threshold. And so if you think about that in terms of the bird's energetic resources, the calories that it needs to survive, that's where the problem comes in. So no one individual person is being malicious or unkind to the bird. It's just a matter of being aware that they have a very important task in order to complete, to survive, to eat and to rest and to migrate, and we're interrupting those tasks.
Amelia Mason, when you rescue a wild bird, how do you eventually determine whether this bird can go back into the wild through rehabilitation or whether the bird has to go to a sanctuary?
Sure. Well, it depends species to species. Rule of thumb basically is the birds have to be at least 95% the way they were before. They have to be fully flighted with no issues. Some birds need to not just be able to fly, but be able to soar. Big difference between soaring and flying. So a vulture might be able to fly and have a tweak in the wing that doesn't allow him to soar. So that would be a big problem for him out in the wild.
When you're talking about soaring, help us understand for those of us who aren't bird experts. What's the difference?
If on a nice, sunny, warm day, you look up and you see vultures circling maybe over a carry-on that they found way, way up high, drifting on the thermal winds, they're not flapping their wings almost at all. You can sometimes watch them soar without a single flap for 30 minutes or more. That's the soaring is a very important part of their hunting practices, being able to conserve energy and kind of catch the whiff of the food on the wind and drift that way without burning all their calories. Their eyesight has to be really good. The eyes have to be checked out. Most birds cannot be released if they don't have full vision. Very few can be released with one eye or an eye issue. Things like that. Are they able to eat on their own, but not just eat, are they able to hunt on their own? Do they have the foot strength? Let's say it's a bird of prey. Does he have the foot strength now after that leg break to grab his prey and to claw it and to tear it apart? If he doesn't, then he's not going to live very long in the wild after release. So we absolutely make doubly extra sure that they are good to go, because we do spend a lot of time and money on these birds, and we'd hate to release something that then just was going to live a month or two and die anyway.
So. Have you ever released a bird into the wild but he doesn't really go away, kind of hangs around?
Well, sometimes they'll do that after a release. They might land and just sort of sit there for a little while. Like if we release pelicans onto the beach, they don't necessarily just fly away right off. They'll sit and get their bearings and look around for a bit. The few occasions here or there, if we did release a bird and we see that he didn't fly very well, we were able to recapture them soon after.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at coastal birds in the Cape Fear region. We're going to explore how they're faring after Hurricane Florence. Amelia Mason of Skywatch Bird Rescue and Lindsay Addison of Audubon, North Carolina are with us today and answering your questions. When we return from the break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We come back, we'll also hear more about vultures. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Bird watchers could catch some interesting birds that aren't usually here in the spring or summer if they're lucky. Today we're exploring coastal bird populations. We're going to look at how they did during and after Florence and some of the anomalies that bird experts are seeing right now. Lindsay Addison is a coastal biologist with Audubon, North Carolina, and Amelia Mason is director of Skywatch Bird Rescue, and they're also answering your questions during this live Thursday edition. You can call us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we get to Jamie's question, Amelia Mason, do you rescue vultures?
We do. We rescue all birds.
And tell us what that's like. Are they different from other birds? Are they more ornery, or
sure,
do they just have a bad reputation?
They're pretty interesting. One of the first things that happens when you capture them is they'll throw up. When they're scared, they expel.
Oh.
If they do have food in their crop, it's a survival tactic. They'll expel that. Herons and pelicans will sometimes do the same thing. So it's sort of there's two reasons they do that, and maybe more, but two most common is they're trying to expel the food, so the predator is distracted by that while they take off. And then the other reason is the very pestiferous smell that they'll put out is very off-putting. So those are two survival tactics. So unfortunately, when we capture them, you can smell the vulture arriving before you even see him.
How would you describe the smell?
It's horrible. It's like it's like rotten meat and throw up mixed. It's awful. It's horrible, horrendous smell. And they'll bite. They bite quite hard, and they'll hiss. They make a hissing, sort of hoarse, growling type noise at us, hiss and growl at us. So, yeah, they're interesting, but I love them. I love vultures. They're one of my favorites.
And
species.
Does that make you love them more, the fact that they're so stinky and ornery?
Yes, the fact they're so awful and horrible, and they have certain techniques of cooling down in the summer that's even more gross that I won't go into right now.
Oh, please do. How do they cool down?
Lindsay's laughing. They'll poop on their legs.
That's fantastic.
But it's a really good strategy, though, is it poop, then the evaporative cooling
effect there on your legs.
So their poop is very runny. It's watery.
They don't knock it till you've tried it.
Yeah, hey, exactly. I mean, you know, desperate times, I guess. So this water will kind of pour all over their legs. It's a white liquid. And then as it evaporates, it'll cool them down. It cools the blood flow in their legs down. So, yeah, they're special. They're quite special birds.
That's even better than I thought.
Right?
You're listening to Coastline.
Yeah, it's a joy to work with the vultures.
It's a look at the coastal bird population today and how humans might consider some simple changes to protect these birds. Lindsay Addison is a coastal biologist with Audubon NC. Amelia Mason is director of Skywatch Bird Rescue. And they're taking your questions. Any question on this live Thursday edition, you can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Jamie is asking about the local populations of songbirds affected by the aftermath of Hurricane Florence and what people can do to help them. She says she's particularly fond of chickadees. And I know, Lindsay Addison, your area of expertise are the water birds, right, the coastal birds. But can you kind of give us an overview of what you know about what's happened with birds as a result of Florence here?
Yeah, sure. I can venture into the backyard a little bit. One of the most important things that you can do to help your local backyard birds, especially after a hurricane when the winds may have blown a lot of the berries or natural food sources off of the shrubs and trees, or where you may have actually had loss of vegetation to your property, is to add back native plants, which provide food sources for birds like chickadees, cardinals, all those great birds that you enjoy seeing at your feeder. You can also, of course, put out a bird feeder, and there's a lot of different types of bird feeders, different types of bird food. But planting native plants is a really great way to make your yard more attractive and more beneficial to our local bird populations. Chickadees are wonderful feeder birds, but they'll also eat berries and insects. So if you plant, for example, a wax myrtle, it has little, neat little gray berries. In fact, the name derives from the waxy coating on those berries that early settlers used to make candles out of. So you've got the berries for birds that are going to use that. But then they're native plants, and they're host to scads of insects. And those are high-protein, high-value little meals for those birds as well. So when you plant native plants, they get more insects on them because our native insect population is adapted to use our native plant population. And there's usually also a lull in the fall for people who enjoy feeding birds because there's a lot of berries and abundant food sources naturally. So you might see the use of your feeder fall off a little bit. And then, you know, as we get into these colder days, things should probably pick up. I've seen that happen at my feeder in the past month or so. But native plants are a really great way to help out chickadees and all those other backyard bird species. And if you go to nc.audubon.org, we have information on native plants specific for your region in North Carolina. So you can get that information and then go to local nurseries in order to find them.
And just to be clear, is it too early for biologists to really figure out what happened to different bird populations as a result of Florence? I mean, I know, Amelia, your situation is really different because it's much more immediate. But when you're talking about the impact on bird populations, do we know?
It's probably a little early for some of it, because one of the most, when people ask how are the birds doing, which I'm often asked, it's a simple question with a complicated process and a complicated answer, because, you know, one of the most basic ways of knowing how are my bird populations doing is how many are there. But how do you count all the birds? And we do have particular censuses and surveys that we do on a regular basis throughout the year in order to help assess populations and trends. And we are going to be going into our nesting season starting in March, just around the corner, and we'll be able to see if how the nesting habitat is held up. We've gone out to the sites that I've gone out to the sites that Audubon North Carolina manages to see how they've done. For example, we manage Lihue Taff Island, which is the island that's north of Figure Eight, so between Figure Eight and Topsail Island. And that island experienced overwash, where the storm surge came up, knocked over the dunes, and changed the topography of the island, creating more bare sandy areas. Now, humans go out there and think, oh, that looks terrible. Oh, the destruction. There's no destruction on Lihue Taff Island, only change. And that's how barrier islands naturally coexist with the weather and the tides and the currents. And that bare sand that's been created by the dunes being knocked over is going to be excellent nesting habitat next year. So I expect to see more birds nesting on Lihue Taff Island, things like American oyster catchers, least terns, Wilson's plovers. And one of the biggest challenges beach nesting birds face is human disturbance. If you're detecting a theme, it's because there is a theme. So if you're trying to raise your babies, you don't need big giants walking around where where the nursery is. So we put up signs and string to help people stay out of those areas so the birds can be undisturbed and raise their young in peace. And so that's an example of a type of habitat that appears that it's going to have been benefited by Hurricane Florence. Now, some of our natural islands on the lower Cape Fear River experienced erosion. So these are marsh islands with spartina, which is the sort of the marsh grass that you see everywhere in salt marshes. And they've got these rakes, so dead oyster shells. So that kind of line the marsh edge. And that's where a lot of other birds nest. And those rakes got pushed down and lowered by the storm surge. So that habitat has not been benefited by Hurricane Florence. So we may see less success from the American oyster catchers and other species nesting on those islands.
Now, does that necessarily mean the population has been harmed, or do they just go somewhere else?
Now, depending on the species, so the population, we did have some direct mortality from Florence, and we know this from some folks that found dead oyster catchers that were banded. They have little bracelets on their legs with a unique code, and they contact, they report it. There's a website, you report it. And so we know that some died directly during or after the storm. But a lot of them, we know from reciting banded individuals since Florence, that they've survived. But so their population has probably not been greatly affected in terms of numbers right now. But if their productivity, the number of young they can produce, has been impacted because their habitat isn't as good in some of these natural islands, then over time we might see fewer birds because they're, you know, creating fewer young. So sometimes population level stuff gets complicated because it's not only a question of how many there are, which is a tough question for birds that fly around and are widely distributed over big geographies, and they migrate, but also because you have to know about how many young they're producing and the survivorship of the young through their juvenile period until they start to breed as well. But overall, Florence gave us a little bit, and Florence took a little bit away from us in terms of how it's impacting habitat for our local nesting birds and to some extent their populations.
Amelia Mason of Skywatch, when a storm like Florence happens, there is immediate fallout for you. What did you see right after the storm?
Right after the storm, we were flooded with phone calls, bombarded. I mean, literally every 5 minutes the phone would ring. We were expecting to get a lot of songbirds and maybe birds of prey, and surprisingly, we did not. The main birds that we were flooded with, you know, several dozen, were woodcocks, killdeer, black skimmers, and there were a few gulls, but it was mainly those four species, woodcocks, skimmers, and the killdeer, surprisingly. They did not do well with all that thrashing of the wind and the rain.
Are those the birds that tend to nest on the ground?
Yes. Killdeer are the little ground nesting. They'll pick inconvenient spots like the side of your driveway or the middle of a parking lot, because they tend to be attracted to the color of the gravel or surrounding areas, a kind of speckledness that camouflages their eggs. So, we were bombarded with phone calls. It was difficult to get all the birds in because roads were flooded, so folks couldn't reach us and we couldn't reach them. So a lot of just phone support happened, you know, what to do in the meantime, how to keep the bird until we can get to you, that kind of thing.
And what would you tell people? Like, if something such as Florence were to come up again and you just couldn't get out, I mean, everybody was...
Yeah, it took probably at least 3 days for us to be able to reach or be able to find roads that were open to reach those folks and vice versa.
So what kinds of, like, if I called you about a killdeer, what,
the rule of thumb is, what would you tell me? Always tell people if you have a wild, and this can transfer over to any wild animal, but if you have a wild bird in your possession, warm, dark, and quiet. Just follow the rules of warm, dark, and quiet. So in other words, confine the bird in a box or a container, not a bird cage. Don't go to PetSmart and buy a cage. It does, they can get their heads stuck in the bars. It causes a lot of feather damage. A box is ideal. Make sure it's closed, whether it has a lid or cover it with a towel. Make sure the bird is sitting on a towel. Some soft substrate is nice so that if they do defecate, there's something to absorb the fluids. Dark, so you can put them in a bathroom and hit the lights and close the door and cover it up and quiet. Don't attempt to feed. Don't drip water in its mouth. And this is a tough one for people, but don't talk to the bird and pet the bird. We have an immediate nurturing response to talk to the animal, but they don't understand what we're saying, right? They don't speak English, and all you're doing is
scaring
them.
And it's not comforting them.
Yes.
It's doing the opposite
they
of what you're
trying. They think you're the predator.
Yeah.
They think they've been captured, and they think you're about to eat them. That's just a natural instinct. So now if you talk to them and pet them and take pictures and selfies, you're causing unnecessary audible stress and visual stress. And some birds can die just from stress alone. We've seen that quite often where the injury itself is minor, but they've been petted by the children and sniffed by the dog and water dripped in their mouth and talked to so much that they literally stress themselves to death. It's well-meaning. You know, people mean well, but you're literally killing it with kindness. So warm, dark, and quiet, covered up. It doesn't want to see you. It doesn't want to hear you until you can get to the rescue.
We had a call. Ken from Wilmington asked, how are the painted buntings on Bald Head Island faring after the storm? Lindsay Addison.
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. I know they had a lot of flooding, and so I guess they'll have to wait till spring to see how the habitat's done and how the painted buntings are going to respond. But I haven't been in touch with anyone on Bald Head about that specific species. They are one of our most charismatic species, though. So good question, and probably one for the Bald Head Island Conservancy.
Good answer. Jim writes, do you know how to tell the difference, and I think he's asking me this, not you two bird experts, between crows and ravens? No, Jim, I don't. Yes, ravens are larger as a rule, but there is more. The long feathers on the wings are called pinions. Ravens have 17, crows have 16. The difference between ravens and crows is a matter of opinion. Oh. So what is the difference between ravens and crows?
I don't think we really have ravens here.
Their distribution, they're found more in the western part of the state.
Yeah.
A raven is a larger bird. They're in the same family, the corvids, and that means they're very intelligent and very social. Jays, so the blue jay that comes to your yard is also a cousin. And the raven is a bigger bird with a heavier bill and some differences in the plumage, as we've discussed. And it's great to have some good bird humor in there. That's always fun. But they're both really interesting birds, even though, you know, crows are common here. We see them. We have fish crows and American crows here in the Cape Fear region. Even though they're common, they're really fun because they are so intelligent. They live in family groups. And so if you have, I have a pack of crows that live in my neighborhood, and they're always into everything. They're very alert to whatever's going on in the neighborhood. And so even common birds can be fun to observe and watch, especially intelligent species like crows and ravens.
Have you ever rescued one of those, Amelia?
Yeah, we receive our fair share of crows each year. Some will come in with, you know, dog attack wounds or cat wounds or vehicle collisions, things like that, or natural disease. Broken wing is usually a common issue for them. Sometimes we see them shot with pellet guns, all type. But yeah, we got our fair share of crows, probably, you know, a couple of dozen a year we'll get in.
After Hurricane Florence, you, Amelia Mason of Skywatch Bird Rescue, also had to deal with chickens and other kinds of, are they domesticated waterfowl that people just kind of abandoned?
Yeah, we got a lot of chickens after the hurricane due to the fact that many people lost their homes and their backyards were flooded and coops washed away. Some people willingly brought chickens and surrendered them because they could no longer house them. Others were found by rescuers just floating around. A whole group of them came in that were found in their crates, floating and drowning. So people stepped in and rescued them as best they could, and brought. We probably received nearly 100 chickens after the hurricane, unfortunately.
That was only a few months ago. So how many do you have now?
Too many. We have too many chickens.
What do you do with all the
chickens?
Would
you like a rooster? Can you take a rooster home?
I wish I could.
We have tons of chickens right now. We place them up for adoption. It's hard to find adoptive homes. We get many inquiries, but we're pretty strict about who we adopt out to, again, because we put a lot of time and money in these birds. So we're not just going to give them away willy-nilly and put them in another situation where, you know, they might not be cared for very well. So we always ask, we either do a site visit to come and see what kind of housing do you have for the chickens, a proper coop. Nighttime predator protection is a requirement that I set out. And if you're far away, we ask for pictures of the housing, and most of the applicants that apply don't send pictures. So we don't consider the application at all. If you didn't include some pictures or a way for us to come and visit the site, then we just move on to the next application.
And would you consider giving the chickens to someone who would eventually use them for food?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a loaded question. of course, if people were planning on doing that, they wouldn't tell us necessarily. That's a fine line to walk.
I'm glad I don't have to make that call.
You know, yeah, we have vegan activists and other folks.
But that's not what you're after, right? Those aren't the kinds of...
No, we don't give them away with the knowledge that you're just going to eat them. Again, we're rescue them, and if you were going to keep them to use their eggs, we're fine with that. It's all about, are you properly caring for the animals? Are they going to be able to see a vet when they're injured? Are you going to make sure they don't have parasites? Proper food and water every day, free roam, etc.
You're listening to Coastline. Coastal bird populations are the focus today. Have you seen anomalies in your neighborhood, birds you don't normally see, or the disappearance of birds you usually do see? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org with your own observations. When we come back after this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Protecting orphaned, injured, or displaced birds is the mission of the local nonprofit Skywatch Bird Rescue. Founder and director Amelia Mason is helping us debunk some popular myths around dealing responsibly with birds, both wild and exotic. And Lindsay Addison is a coastal biologist with Audubon NC. She specializes in coastal birds, such as pelicans, terns, skimmers, ibises, egrets. Not a comprehensive list. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question in. And Dan says, Seabiscuit Wildlife Shelter, great place to visit. Please leave a tip. Mary Ellen Rogers does awesome service to injured birds. And yes, we've heard wonderful things about Mary Ellen Rogers.
Yeah, and I will say that we bring our injured birds that I find in the course of my work at our sites that we manage, I bring them both to Skywatch and to Seabiscuit, and just depending on the logistics of which is the closer spot to bring the birds so it has less stress during travel. And so it's wonderful to have not just one, but two local great nonprofits that do such a good job with wild bird rehab.
And where are they geographically? Seabiscuit is Oak Island, right? And
yeah.
So Skywatch, Amelia Mason, is
where? We're in Castlehaine, I-40 West. Just a few minutes. You'll take the Castlehaine exit, and it's literally just a couple of turns, and you're there.
One of our colleagues wanted to ask about the impacts of domestic cats on local bird populations. Biologist Lindsay Addison, we'll let you take that one.
this is another one of those hairy issues, no pun intended, talking about mammals here. But domestic cats, when they are outside, are very dangerous for birds as well as for other local native wildlife, including amphibians, rats and mice,
squirrels.
So really, the other side of that coin is that if your cat is outside, your cat is subject to all kinds of dangers. Strikes by cars, our increasing local coyote population, cruelty by people who, you know, see a cat and just aren't nice at all. So the best thing you can do for wild bird populations is to keep your cat indoors or keep it enclosed in a catio or some other type of restraint. There are people who've trained their cats to walk on leashes. So it's safer for the cat and it's safer for wildlife. I'm sure Amelia...
Absolutely. Cats live longer anyway, being kept indoors. I understand it's not necessarily possible with all cats to keep them indoors, especially people that rescue and feed feral cats, things like that. But we always encourage those folks who say, oh, my cat can't stay indoors, is to put a leash around its neck, or I'm sorry, a collar with some jingle bells. Very, very important. And then people will say, well, they lose the jingle bells. Well, like I did with one of my cats, take a zip tie and zip tie those suckers on there. Three or four jingle bells, or upgrade from a cat collar to a small dog collar. The cat can still break away in an emergency. He won't be trapped in the collar. But that little jingle that they give off when they're walking or running, it gives the bird just a couple extra seconds to get away, and that makes a world of difference. Keep in mind, if your cat catches an adult bird, songbird, let's say it catches a robin today, that's one robin dead. But if he catches, if he catches a young fledgling hopping on the ground, that's one bird dead, and that's going to happen sometimes. But if he catches a mama robin, that's five babies in the nest. That's now also going to die. So it has a butterfly effect. It doesn't just affect one bird. Some nestlings cannot survive without both parents being alive. So that few extra seconds that you give the bird a chance to get away makes the world of difference.
And I do want to get to how people should deal with baby birds, because I know, Amelia, that's a big issue for you, and you try to do a lot of education around that. We've got a lot of questions coming in. Robert from Wilmington says, I've been a woodsman for over 50 years. I've seen a decline in doves, quails, songbirds. Is this tied to Roundup, the pesticide? What do you think? Amelia?
Quail, I can 100% agree with, definitely. We've literally never received a quail in for rehab. I've not seen them in the wild. I don't know if you've seen them in the wild, but my understanding is they used to be very populated around this area, and now they're almost completely vanished.
Well, being habitat specialists, it makes it more difficult when we convert woodlands or change the forests. The quail population is one of those first things that diminishes.
And it could be a combination of reasons, pesticides, outdoor cats, deforestation, you know, cutting down trees and shrubs and putting up more condos. I believe it's a combination of issues. We still get our fair share of songbirds and doves. I guess it depends on where you live, too, if you've seen a decline in your area for those species.
Are doves better at urbanizing than, say, quail?
Oh, by far, yeah.
They're a great yard bird.
Yeah.
And Sally from Wilmington asks, what, if anything, can people feed seagulls? And this is interesting because a 10-year-old boy told me proudly just 2 days ago, we went to the park and we fed all of the ducks Wonder Bread.
Yay.
And he was so proud because he'd given them a meal. So what's wrong with that?
Okay. Where do we start?
Ducks versus
gulls. Okay, they're both rolling up their sleeves.
Gulls and I'll do gulls real quick and then I'll throw you over to the bread.
Go ahead. Yeah,
but generally, it's a really bad idea to feed birds on the beach. They don't need to be fed your french fries or your other snack food. It's probably not very nutritious for them. Gulls are scavengers. They're also very bold, and you might end up acclimating the gull to being a little bit more forward with people than it should be, and so maybe it decides to try to swoop in on someone else's burger or
fry. Those are some of the best videos.
And then they get really upset at the gull. Yep. The other thing is that leaving food waste behind, maybe the gulls don't pick all of it up, it attracts gulls to an area. What if there's a nesting oyster catcher in that same area, and now you're attracting more gulls, and they're going to see the oyster catcher's chick in the same light as they see mm-hmm. your Dorito, which is just more food to eat. So feeding gulls is generally a bad idea. The one place where I think it probably does very little harm and it is seems to be permitted is the North Carolina ferry system. So you're not near a bird nesting area when you're in transit on the ferry. You go out to the fantail in the back and throw your food up in the air. But keep in mind, most of the snack food you're throwing out is not very nutritious for those birds.
Probably not for you either.
No.
But that's a whole other
You should probably just
discussion.
Throw it in the ocean and put the garbage in the appropriate place. But anyway.
Right.
So what's wrong with Wonder Bread and Pillsbury Goldfish crackers?
So first of all, birds are professional birds. They know what they're doing. They really don't need your help, right? We don't need to help feed them. They're perfectly able to go find their own food. If you go to a nearby pond or a lake and you like to feed the ducks and geese, there's a few problems with that. For one, the leftover food that rots in the water adds to disease and bacterial infections. You're attracting other predators if you leave food on the bank, like rats and raccoons and et cetera. Bread has no nutritional value for the birds whatsoever. It's an empty calorie. So they might feel full, but they get no nutritional benefit from this. And if waterfowl, like ducks locally or geese, eat bread every day, it diminishes their health. Eventually, they'll have brittle bones. They get inflammatory diseases in their joint, gout. They become sick. Their immune system goes down so that they're more prone to other illnesses. Chicks, goslings, and ducklings that grow up eating too much bread will become deformed. They get a wing deformity called angel wing. That's when you see a duck or a goose and the little wing feathers stick out sideways like this. Almost looks like the wings are broken. That is a condition called angel wing. And it's a deformity because of eating empty calories, poor nutrition while they're growing.
So the principle here isn't so different from ocean plastic and the way some birds see plastic. They think it's a fish or some kind of food. They fill up their stomach with it. They found this in albatross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lindsay
yeah.
Addison, right? And,
correct,
and
yes.
And they open up, the albatross dies from starvation.
Yeah, its belly's full of plastic and that
same idea.
Has killed the bird.
Same concept with the bread. It's a belly full of empty calories. You're not benefiting him at all. First of all, technically by law, you're not supposed to feed wild animals. You're not supposed to feed the ducks and geese. But if you must feed them, if you insist on feeding them, take some lettuce, take some spinach, chop up some tomatoes, some grapes. Some of the waterfowl enjoy dry cat food. But again, don't dump buckets of that in the water and leave it behind. It'll cause other problems. Small amounts. Throw a little bit out and let them finish eating it completely. And then you throw a little bit more. Don't overload it. And then they also become so dependent on the human hand handing out the food that they stop foraging on their own. They stop going to find bugs and fish and eat grass and things like that. It can delay migration sometimes if they're spending too much at a time at a lake or a pond instead of moving forward and moving on. And there's all this food now being thrown out by the humans. It'll delay migration and interrupt. And it just causes all kinds of issues.
Joel from Hampstead says, I've seen 5 breeding pairs of eagles near Figure Eight Island. It appears they're becoming more tolerant of humans. Does this happen? And are golden eagles migratory? Lindsay Addison.
Yes, golden eagles are migratory, and they're not common in North Carolina, but if you're very lucky, you will get to see a golden eagle in North Carolina. And if you're a lister, you can add that to your list. And about the bald eagles, they actually are a fairly adaptable bird. They do a lot of scavenging as well as being kleptoparasites, which means that they stealing parasites, taking from others. You'll often see a bald eagle chasing an osprey, which has gone to all the hard work of actually catching the fish, and the osprey mm-hmm. is trying to save the fish from the bald eagle, which is chasing it in order to make it drop it. And there are places out west in Alaska and in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington where bald eagles populate garbage dumps. Lakes where people cast away their fish carcasses. And so they actually can become quite acclimated to people. I don't think that's happening here. There's not a garbage dump where bald eagles are hanging out. But they do tolerate human presence.
Our iconic American bird is a kleptoparasite.
Yes. And, Benjamin Franklin wanted the wild turkey. So, maybe he knew something.
Yeah. Pelicans are a bird that people are fascinated by. They're one that we see around the region frequently. Lindsay Addison, do they stay with us over the winter? How do they winter?
So, yeah, actually, pelicans are a bird that we'll find here in southeastern North Carolina year-round. We have more of them during the breeding season. Then when they migrate up north they breed as far up as Maryland currently. But we do have a smaller population that winters here. And following Florence, there were not as many as I usually see on the lower Cape Fear River. So the Cape Fear River from Carolina Beach all the way down south to the mouth of the river. But in a typical fall, we'll have several thousand roosting and foraging on the river. And then as the weather drops off and we get those first really cold nights, most of them will leave, migrate south. We know from banding that a lot of them winter in the southeastern United States, Georgia, Florida, as well as into the Caribbean.
So they don't travel that far.
No, they're a shorter distance migrant. Now, as opposed to, you know, some of the sandpipers, that the little brown birds you see running around on the beach, those birds are going thousands, and most of the pelicans are going 1,000 or fewer miles. But we always do have some. You can go down to Masonboro Inlet or Rich Inlet, and you'll see a few brown pelicans all winter. And a lot of those birds, again, from banding, breed up in Virginia or Maryland, so we kind of have a shifting of the guard. So a lot of our local breeders will be getting out of Dodge.
Amelia Mason, I want to make sure we get to, you have very strong opinions about parrots. And
A
lot of people think that they make such great pets because they can relate to humans so well.
Right.
But
there's a certain allure about a parrot that, you know, people want to own them. First of all, visually, they're exciting. And then people always ask, can it talk? Well, it can't really talk. It mimics, right? Just like crows and jays, they mimic sounds and they might figure out when to say those things. But he's not carrying a conversation on with a parrot, right? They don't truly speak English. I do not think that breeding should be allowed. I think exotic bird breeding should be banned. There are thousands and thousands of parrots all across the U.S. that are up for adoption. There are thousands of parrots living in homes that don't want them, unwanted homes.
Why does that happen so frequently?
A relative might die that have parrots, and those parrots then, you know, somebody else gets saddled with them in the family who really doesn't want them. So they give them food and water, but that bird stays locked up in a cage that's 1.5 by 1.5 foot big and live the rest of their lives basically imprisoned. There's no stimulation. They don't get enough exercise. They don't get enough mental stimulation. Their intelligence level is so high that they need constant entertainment and interaction and to be stimulated. They just can't sit in a cage all day on a perch and be happy with just food and water.
So who
That's
is
why
an
they
ideal?
Become depressed. They become agitated. They begin to scream. They begin to bite. I would never recommend someone to adopt a parrot or to own a parrot. If you have a normal job or a day job, do not get a parrot.
Who would be a good kind of person?
Someone
to
that's
get
retired.
A parrot?
Someone that spend that has all day long to spend with that, because that parrot wants to bond with you, make a strong. Essentially, you're replacing their mate. They want to bond with you. They want to spend several hours a day on you, with you, physically.
So someone who wants to mate with a parrot.
Right, exactly. Be married to a parrot. And that's really the relationship that they seek out with a mate, with a human, is that we're essentially married. They want to go where you go. They want to be with you all day. They don't want to leave your side. So if you have a lot of time on your hands, a parrot would be a rewarding pet. But if you have a job or kids, I would never recommend someone to get a parrot. This is why we see them bounce from home to home to home to home. We have a parrot at the rescue, for example. She's only 10 years old, and she had 24 homes before coming to us. By the time she reached us, she was chewing her feet literally down to almost bloody stumps. She was so agitated, and she had such PTSD, because it's essentially a four-year-old child in the foster system being rejected by that family and just being rejected over and over and over and being passed around and around. It's very sad. There's parrots in the wild that are nearly extinct, yet we have them here in the U.S. being bred as pets. So it's an unbalanced.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Amelia Mason, Lindsay Addison, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
It was fun.
Thanks.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. Or find it on the HQR app. You can also listen to the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. ¶¶